The bank and... Dr. Shaw cut me off with a smile. That won't be necessary, Mara. Thank you for... catching her. Did you say? I swallowed and my eyes flicked to my shoes before I met her gaze. Yes, I found her. Dr. Shaw looked skeptical, but she smiled. Thank you for bringing her in. She wouldn't have lasted much longer. If she only knew. An image of her owner's body lying on blood-darkened mud flickered in my mind again, and I tried not to let it show on my face. I thanked Noah's mother profusely, and then he and I headed back to the car. Noah's stride was twice as long as mine, and he'd got there first, opening the passenger door for me. Thanks, I said before glancing at his smug, self-satisfied expression. For everything. You're welcome, he said, his voice laced with obnoxious triumph. As expected. Now, are you going to tell me how you really found the dog? I turned away from his stare. What are you talking about? I hope he wouldn't notice that I couldn't look him in the eye. You were walking Mabel on a slip lead when I saw you. There's no way she was wearing that from the wounds on her neck. Where'd you get it? Being trapped, I did what any self-respecting liar would do. I changed the subject. My eyes fell on his clothes. Why do you always look like you've just rolled out of bed? Because usually I have. And the way he raised his eyebrow at me made me blush. Classy, I said. Noah leaned back and laughed. The sound was raucous. I loved it immediately, then mentally flogged myself for the thought, but his eyes crinkled at the corners and his smile illuminated his entire face. The light changed, and Noah, still smiling, took his hands off the steering wheel and reached into his pocket, withdrawing the cigarettes. He drove with his knee as he tapped one out in his hand, flicked open a small, silver lighter, and lit up in one fluid movement. I tried to ignore the way his lips curved around the cigarette, how he held it pinched between thumb and third finger, and drew it almost reverently to his mouth. That mouth. Smoking was a bad habit, yes, but he looked so good doing it. I hate uncomfortable silences, Noah said, interrupting my less-than-clean thoughts. He tilted his head back slightly, and a few strands of his spiking, curling hair caught a shaft of sunlight that filtered through the car window. They make me nervous, he said. That comment warranted an eye roll. I have a hard time believing anything makes you nervous. The words rang true. It was impossible to imagine that Noah was anything but comfortable all the time, and not just comfortable, bored. Bored and gorgeous, and I was sitting next to him, close. My pulse raced to catch up with my thoughts. There was some villainy afoot, absolutely. It's true, he continued. I totally freak out when people look at me as well. I call shenanigans, I said, as the sounds of Miami floated in through the window. What? Noah looked at me, all innocence. You're not shy. No? No, I said, narrowing my eyes. And pretending to be makes you look like a jackass. Noah feigned offense. You've wounded me to the core with your profane characterization. Pass the tissues. Noah broke into an easy smile as the cars in front of us lurched forward. All right. Maybe shy isn't the right word, he said, but I do get... anxious when there are too many people around. I don't really like attention. He then studied me carefully, a vestige of my dark and mysterious past. It was a struggle not to laugh in his face. Really? He took another long drag on his cigarette. No, I was just an awkward kid. I remember being like 12 or 13 and all my friends had little girlfriends, and I'd go to sleep and feel like a loser, wishing that one day I could grow up and just be fit.
Fit?
Yeah, fit. Hot. Anyway, I did.
Did what?
I woke up one morning, went to school, and the girls noticed me back. Rather nerving, actually.
His candor caught me a little off guard. I tried not to let it show. Poor Noah, I said and sighed. He smirked and stared straight ahead.
I figured out what to do with it eventually, but not until we moved here, unfortunately.
I'm sure you worked it out just fine.
He turned to me and arched an eyebrow.
The girls here are boring. And the arrogance was back. We Americans are so uncouth, I said.
Not Americans.
Just the girls here at Croydon. I noticed then that we were back in the parking lot and parked. How did that happen? Most of them, anyway, Noah finished. You seem to be managing.
I was, but things are looking up this week in particular.
So awful. I shook my head slowly, not even bothering to hide my grin.
You're not like other girls,
I snorted.
Seriously?
And Jamie said he was smooth.
Seriously, he replied, missing my sarcasm, or ignoring it.
Noah took a final drag on his stub of a cigarette, breathed the smoke out of his flared nostrils, and flicked the remains of the cancer stick out the window. My mouth fell open.
Did I just see you litter?
I'm driving a hybrid. It cancels out.
You're horrible, I said without conviction.
I know, Noah said with it. He smiled, then reached over my lap to open my door, brushing my arm with his as he leaned across my body. He cracked my door open but didn't move away. His face was inches from mine, and I could see hints of gold in his perpetual 5 o'clock shadow. He smelled like sandalwood and ocean, but only faintly of smoke. My breath caught in my throat. When my cell phone rang, I jumped so forcefully that I hit my head on the roof of Noah's car.
What the f-
The phone continued to ring, ignorant of my pain. The lyrics of Tupac's Dear Mama that Joseph had programmed for my ringtone indicated the culprit.
I'm sorry, I have to-
Wait, Noah started. My heart galloped in my chest, and only partly from surprise. Noah's lips were inches away from my face. My phone was protesting in my hand, and I was in trouble.
Chapter 15. I mustered up every ounce of free will I had and extracted myself from his car. I gave him a half-hearted wave as I shut the door behind me. I answered the phone. Hello?
Mara, where are you?
My mother sounded frantic.
I turned the key in the ignition of Daniel's car and glanced at the clock. I was seriously late. Not good.
I'm driving home now. My tires squealed as I reversed out of the spot and almost hit a parked black Mercedes in the spot behind me.
Where have you been?
She asked. She was counting every nanosecond I hesitated, so I went with the truth. I found a starving dog near the school, and she was in really bad shape, so I had to take her to the vet. There. There was a silence on the end before she finally asked, "Where is it now?"
Some jerk honked behind me as I turned onto the expressway.
"Where's what?"
"The dog, Mara."
"Still at the vet.
How did you pay for it?"
"I didn't. A classmate saw me and he took me to his mom, a vet, and she treated her for free."
"Well, that's convenient," she said.
There it was, that edge to her voice. I was in it, and deep. I didn't respond.
"I'll see you when you get home," my mother said abruptly.
I was not looking forward to it, but I slammed on the gas at the first opportunity anyway. I dared the cops to pull me over, pushing 90 when I could. I wove in and out of lanes at every opportunity. I ignored the irritated honking. Miami was infecting me. It wasn't long before I pulled into the driveway at home. I crept into the house like a criminal, hoping to be able to sneak into my room without being seen. But my mother was perched on the arm of the sofa in the sunken living room. She'd been waiting for me. Neither of my brothers was within sight or hearing. Curse them.
"Let's talk." Her expression was unnaturally calm. I braced myself for the onslaught.
"You have to answer the phone when I call. Every time."
"I didn't realize it was you calling before. I didn't recognize the number."
"It's my office number, Mara. I told you to program it in as soon as we moved, and left you a voicemail."
"Well, I didn't have time to listen to it, sorry."
My mother leaned forward, and her eyes searched my face.
"Is there really a dog?"
I stared straight back into them, defiant.
"Yes."
"So if I call the vet's office tomorrow morning and ask about it, they'll confirm?"
"You don't trust me?"
My mother didn't respond. She just sat there, eyebrows raised, waiting for me to say something. I gritted my teeth, then spoke.
"The vet's name is Dr. Shaw, and her office near school," I said.
"Oh, I don't remember the street address."
Her expression didn't change.
I was sick of this.
"I'm going to my room," I said.
When I turned around, she let me go. I closed the door a bit too forcefully, trapped in my room. I couldn't delay thinking about what happened today any longer. Noah, Mabel, her owner, his death. Things were changing. Sweat pebbled my skin, even though I knew it wasn't possible. It wasn't possible. I was in class at 9 this morning when that bastard died. He had to have died earlier.
The coroner, whoever he was wrong. Even he'd said he was just guessing. That was it. I imagined my conversation with him. I thought he snuck up on me too quietly, but he didn't sneak up on me at all. He was already dead. The whole thing was just another hallucination. Par for the course, really, considering my PTSD. But still, today felt different. Confirmation that I was now crazier than I'd known it was possible for me to be. My mother worked with only the mildly disturbed. I was full-on delusional, abnormal, psychotic. When I joined my family for dinner that night, I felt strangely, disturbingly calm as I ate, as if watching the whole thing from distance. I even managed to be polite to my mother. In a way, it was oddly comforting, the conviction of my insanity. The man died before I met him this morning. Wait, no, I never met him. I invented the conversation between us to give me a feeling of power over the situation in which I felt powerless, my mother's words, but they sounded about right. I was powerless to bring Rachel back, she'd said, after I was released from the hospital, right before she mentioned, pushed, the idea of counseling and or drugs to help me cope. And of course now, I was powerless to leave Florida and go back home. But a skinny, neglected, abandoned dog was something I could fix. So that was it then. I was truly crazy. But then why did I feel like there was something else? Something I was missing. My mother's laughter at the dinner table brought me back to the present. Her whole face lit up when she smiled, and I felt guilty for freaking her out. I decided not to tell her about my little adventure today. If she watched me any closer, she'd turn into the Eye of Sauron. And then she'd follow through on her threat of therapy and medication. Neither option sounded particularly appealing, and really, now that I knew what was happening, I could deal with it. Until I fell asleep. Chapter 16. Before. We pulled into a long driveway, guarded by a rusting iron gate. Thick branches of leafless trees twisted over the car, rasping in the wind. Our headlights provided the only light on the silent road, despite the artificial heat. I shivered. Jude put his arm around me and turned down Death Cab on the speakers. I looked out the window. The headlights flashed over an idling car about 20 feet away, and I instantly recognized it as Claire's. The glass was fogged, and she cut the engine as we pulled up. I reached for the door, and Jude reached for my waist. I gritted my teeth. I was already on edge, and wasn't up to fending him off again tonight. I twisted away. They're waiting for us. He didn't let me go. You sure you're ready? He looked skeptical. Hell yes, I lied. I smiled for emphasis. Because we can turn around if you want. I can't say his suggestion wasn't appealing. Warm covers usually went over midnight excursions in the freezing cold. But tonight was different. Rachel had been begging me to do this since last year. And now that she had Claire in her corner, my neuroses could cost me my best friend. So instead of saying yes, emphatically yes, I rolled my eyes. I said I was in, I'm in. Or we could just stay here. Jude pulled me toward him, but I turned my head so that he caught my cheek. Do you want to turn around? I asked, even though I knew the answer. Jude pulled away, irritated. I've already done this. It's just an old building, big deal. He launched himself out of the car and I followed. He'd be pissy later, but it was worth it. We'd been dating for only 2 months, and during the first one, I actually liked him. Who wouldn't? He was the picture of all-American wholesomeness. Dark blonde hair and green eyes, same as Claire's. Big linebacker shoulders. And he was sweet. Syrup sweet. For the first month. But lately, not as much. The passenger door of Claire's car slammed, and Rachel bounded out to meet me, her dark hair flouncing behind her. Mara, I'm so glad you came. Claire thought you'd chicken out the last minute. She hugged me. I glanced at Claire, still huddled by the car. Her eyes narrowed slightly in return. She looked unfriendly and disappointed, likely hoping that I wouldn't show up. I lifted my chin. And miss my chance to spend the night in this illustrious insane asylum? Never. I placed an arm over Rachel and grinned at her, then looked pointedly at Claire. What took you so long? Claire asked us. Jude shrugged. Mara overslept. Claire smiled coldly. Why am I not surprised? I opened my mouth to say something obnoxious, but Rachel took my hand, which had frozen solid in the few moments I'd been outside, and spoke first. It doesn't matter. She's here now. This is going to be so much fun, I promise. I looked up at the imposing Gothic building in front of us. Fun. Oh, yes. Jude blew into his hands and pulled his gloves on. I steeled myself in anticipation of the long-ass night to come. I could do this. I would do this. Claire had made fun of me for freaking out after Rachel's birthday party for the last time. I was sick of hearing about the Ouija board incident, and after tonight, I wouldn't have to. As I stared at the building, fear seeped into my bloodstream. Rachel withdrew her camera from her pocket and opened the shutter, then took my right hand again as Jude moved to hold my left. Still, their company and the contact didn't make what we were about to do less terrifying. But I'd be damned before I freak out in front of Claire. Claire took out her video camera from her backpack before slinging it over her shoulder. She started walking toward the building and Rachel followed, pulling me along behind her. We reached a dilapidated fence with several no trespassing signs plastered along the length of the weathered wood, and I reflexively looked back up at the ominous institution above me, towering over us like something out of a Poe poem. The architecture of the Tamerlane State Lunatic Asylum was formidable, made more sinister by the creepy ivy that snaked its way along the front steps and expansive brick walls. The stone window facades crumbled in decay. The plan was to spend the night in the abandoned building and head home at dawn. Rachel and Claire wanted to thoroughly explore it and try to find the children's wing and the rooms where shock therapy was administered. According to Rachel's canonical horror literature, those would be the rooms most likely to contain any paranormal activity, and she and Claire planned to document our adventure for posterity. Hooray. Jude inched closer to me, and I was actually grateful for his presence as Rachel and Claire scaled the rotting wood fence. Then it was my turn. Jude gave me a lift, but I hesitated as I grabbed the fragile wood. After a few words of encouragement, I finally hoisted myself over with his help. I landed hard, into a rustling pile of decaying leaves. The easiest way into the building was through the basement. Chapter 17. I knew Rachel wanted to go to the asylum, but until the night after Mabel's piece of shit owner died, I didn't remember why I agreed. On Saturday, I tried to prepare myself to dream more, to remember more, to watch her die. I crawled into my sheets shaking, wanting and not wanting to see her again. I did, but it was the same dream. Nothing new on Sunday night either. It was a good sign, the remembering. It was happening slowly, but it was happening nonetheless. And without a psychologist or mind-altering chemicals, my mind was obviously altered enough. I was almost glad to have Mabel to wonder and worry about all weekend, even if I couldn't bring myself to try and find out Noah's phone number. I figured I'd ask him how the dog was in English on Monday, but when I got to class, he wasn't there. Instead of listening, my mind and my pencil wandered over my sketchbook, drifting lazily as Miss Lieb collected our papers and discussed the difference between tragic heroes and anti-heroes. Each time a student left or entered the classroom, my gaze shifted to the door, waiting for Noah to stroll in before the next bell rang, but he never did. When class ended, I glanced at the drawing before closing the book and stuffing it in my bag. Noah's charcoal eyes squinted at me from the page, cast downward, the skin around them crinkled in laughter. His thumb grazed his bottom lip as his hand curled in a lazy fist at his brilliantly smiling mouth. He looked almost shy as he laughed. The pale plane of his forehead was smooth, relaxed, mid-chortle. My stomach churned. I flipped to the previous page and noted with horror that I'd traced Noah's elegant profile perfectly, from his high cheekbones down to the slight bump in his solemn nose. And on the page before that, his eyes stared back at me, aloof and unattainable. I was afraid to keep looking. I needed serious help. I shoved the sketchbook in my bag and glanced furtively over my shoulder, hoping no one saw. I was halfway to algebra before I felt a light tap on my back. But when I turned around, no one was there. I shook my head. I felt strange all of a sudden, like I was floating through someone else's dream. By the time I arrived at Mr. Walsh's classroom, I was surrounded by laughter. Some guys whistled when I walked in the room. Because I was finally wearing an iteration of the school uniform? I didn't know. Something was happening, but I didn't understand it. My hands trembled at my sides, so I balled them into fists as I sat at the desk next to Jamie's. That was when I noticed the sound of crunching paper behind me. The crunching of the paper that was taped to my back. So someone did bump into me earlier. That, at least, I hadn't hallucinated. I reached around and pulled the sign off my back, where the word slut was scrawled on a sheet of loose leaf. The quiet snickers then erupted into laughter. Jamie looked up, confused, and I flushed as I crumpled the paper in my fist. Anna threw her head back and roared with laughter. Without thinking about it, I unfurled one of my fists and placed the wad of paper in my flat palm, and then I flicked it in her face. "Creative," I said to her as it hit its target. Anna's tan cheeks turned red first, and then a vein protruded from her forehead. She opened her mouth to fling an insult my way, but Mr. Walsh cut her off before she began. Score. Jamie grinned and clapped me on the shoulder as soon as class ended. "Well played, Mara."
"Thanks."
Aiden pushed past Jamie on his way out the door, slamming Jamie's shoulder into the doorframe. Aiden turned before leaving the room.
"Don't you have a lawn you should be decorating?"
Jamie glared after him and rubbed his shoulder.
"He needs a knife in the eye," he muttered, once Aiden was gone. "So, a-holes aside, how's your first week?"
"Oh, you know, saw a dead guy, losing my mind, same old."
"Not too bad."
Jamie nodded.
"Big change from your old school, is it?"
When he asked me that, a still frame of Rachel materialized in my brain.
"Is it that obvious?"
"You've got public school written all over you."
Thanks."
"Oh, that's a compliment. I've sat in class with these douches for most of my waking life.
It's nothing to be proud of, trust."
"Going to private school or going to Croydon?"
I asked as we made our way to his locker.
"From what I've heard from friends at other schools, I believe this level of asshattery is unique at Croydon. Take Anna, for example. She's only a few IQ points above a corpse, and yet she sullies our Algebra 2 class with her stupidity."
I decided not to mention that I was probably just as confounded by the homework as she was.
"The amount your parents donate is directly proportional to how much murder you're allowed to get away with," Jamie said as he exchanged his books. When a shadow blocked the light filtering in from the midday sun, I looked up. It was Noah. As always, the top button of his collar was undone. His shirt sleeves were carelessly rolled up, and today he wore a skinny, knitted tie, loosely knotted around his neck. I could just make out the black cord that hung around his neck, peeking out from beneath the open collar of his shirt. It was a good look for him. A great look, actually, despite the shadows that stained the skin under his eyes. His hair was in its permanent state of disarray as he ran a hand over his rough jaw. When he caught me staring, I blushed. He smirked, then walked away without saying a word.
"So it begins," Jamie sighed.
"Shut up!" I turned around so he couldn't see me flush a deeper shade of red.
"If he wasn't such a dick, I'd applaud," Jamie said. "You could start a fire with the heat between you two."
"You're mistaking bitter animosity for heartfelt affection," I said. But when I thought about last week and how Noah had been with Mabel, I wasn't so sure if I was right.
Jamie answered with a sad shake of his head. "It's only a matter of time."
I shot him a poisonous look.
"Before?" "Before you're doing the walk of shame out of his den of iniquity."
"Thanks for thinking so highly of me."
"It's not your fault, Mara. Girls can't help falling for Shaw, especially in your case."
"My case?"
"Noah is clearly smitten with you," Jamie said,
his voice dripping with sarcasm. He shut his locker and I spun around to walk away. Jamie followed behind me.
"And that ass don't hurt either."
I smirked over my shoulder at him.
"What's your deal with him anyway?"
"You mean aside from the fact that his attention already has Anna Greenlee gunning for you?"
"Aside from that."
He considered his words, the mulch crunching under our feet as we cut across one of the flower beds to the picnic tables.
"Noah doesn't date. He'll screw you. Literally and figuratively. Everyone knows it. His conquests know it, but they pretend not to care until he moves on to the next one. And then they're alone, and their reputations are shot to hell. Anna's a prime example, but she's only one of many. I heard that a senior from Walden tried to commit suicide after he, well, after he got what he came for, pun intended, and didn't call again."
"Sounds like a major overreaction on her part."
"Maybe, but I wouldn't want to see that happen to you," Jamie said. I raised my eyebrows. You have enough problems, Jamie said, and a wide grin spread across his face.
I returned it. How magnanimous of you.
You're welcome. Consider yourself warned. Much good may it do you.
I shifted my bag to my other shoulder. Thanks for telling me, I said to Jamie. I am not interested, but it's good to know.
Jamie shook his head. Uh-huh. When you're all brokenhearted and listening to sad kill-yourself music after it ends, just remember I told you so.
He walked off and left me at the door to history. Wise were his words, but forgotten in the face of my next class. Lunchtime found me once again scrounging for scraps from the snack machine. I rooted around in my bag for change when I heard footsteps approach. Somehow I didn't need to turn to know who it was. Noah reached around me, brushing my shoulder as he placed a dollar in the machine. I sidestepped out of his way.
What shall I get? He asked.
What do you want?
He looked at me and tilted his head, and one corner of his mouth lifted into a smile.
Well, that's a complicated question.
Animal crackers, then.
Noah looked confused, but he pressed E4 anyway and the machine obeyed. He handed me the box. I handed it back to him, but he laced his hands behind his back.
Keep it, he said. I can buy my own, thanks.
I don't care, he said.
What a surprise, I said.
How's Mabel, by the way? I meant to ask you about her this morning, but you weren't in class.
Noah gave me a blank look. I had a previous engagement. And she's hanging in. She's not going anywhere for a while, though. Whoever let her get that way ought to die a slow, painful death.
Suddenly queasy, I swallowed hard before speaking.
Thank your mom again for taking care of her, I said, trying to shake it off as I made my way to a picnic table. I sat on its pitted surface and opened the box of crackers.
Maybe I just needed to eat.
She was amazing.
I bit the head off an elephant.
Just let me know when I should pick her up.
I will. Noah loped onto the picnic table and sat beside me, leaning back on his arms but staring straight ahead. I munched next to him in silence. Have dinner with me this weekend, he said out of nowhere. I almost choked.
Are you asking me out?
Noah opened his mouth to respond just as a group of older girls burst forth from the stairwell. When they saw him, they arrested their breakneck pace and sashayed suggestively as they walked past us, tossing a chorus of, "Hey, Noah's," behind them. Noah seemed to ignore them, but then the tiniest twitch of a traitorous smile began at the corners of his lips.
That was all the reminder I needed. Thanks for the invitation, but I'm afraid I must decline.
Already have plans. His voice suggested he was merely waiting to hear my excuse. I delivered,
"Yeah, a date with all of the crap I've missed in school," I said, then tried to recover. You know, from transferring in late.
I didn't want to talk about that now, especially not with him. The trimester exams are 20% of our grade, and I can't afford to screw them up.
Oh, I can help you study, Noah said.
I looked at him. The dark lashes that framed his gray-blue eyes weren't helping my situation. Neither was the slightly mischievous smile on his lips. I turned away.
I do better studying on my own.
I don't think that's true, he said.
You don't know me well enough to make that assessment.
So let's change that, then, he said matter-of-factly. He continued to stare straight ahead as a few strands of hair fell forward into his eyes. He was killing me.
Look, Shaw, we're starting with the surname nonsense, are we?
Hysterical. Ask someone else.
I don't want to ask someone else, and you don't really want me to either.
Wrong. I hopped off the table and walked away. If I didn't look at him, I'd be fine. Noah caught up to me in two long strides.
I didn't ask you to marry me. I asked you for dinner. What, are you afraid I'll ruin your image you're cultivating here?
What image? I said flatly.
Angsty, solitary, introspective emo teen, staring off into the distance as she sketches withered leaves falling from bare branches and...
Noah's voice trailed off, but the look of cool amusement on his face didn't.
No. No, that was lovely. Please continue.
I rushed ahead until another girl's bathroom appeared. I pushed the door open, planning to leave Noah outside while I collected myself. But he followed me in. Two younger girls were standing at the mirror, applying lip gloss.
Get out, Noah said to them, his voice laced with boredom. As if they were the ones who didn't belong in the girls' bathroom.
But they didn't wait to be told twice. They scooted out so fast that I would have laughed if I hadn't been so shocked myself.
Noah directed his gaze at me, and something flickered behind his eyes.
"What's your problem?"
he asked in a low voice. I looked at him. Gone was the casual indifference, but he wasn't angry or even annoyed. More like curious. His quiet expression was ruinous.
"I don't have a problem," I said confidently. I took a step forward, eyes narrowed at Noah. "I'm problem-free."
His long frame, accentuated by the spare line of his untucked shirt and slim-cut pants, looked so out of place against the ugly yellow tile. My breathing accelerated.
"I'm not your type," I managed to say. Noah then took a step toward me, and a deviant smile teased the corner of his mouth.
"Damn. I don't have a type."
"That's even worse," I said, and I swear I tried to sound mean when I said it. "You're as indiscriminate as they say." But I wanted him closer.
"I've been slandered."
His voice was barely above a whisper. He took another step, so close that I felt the warm aura of his chest. He looked down at me, all sincere and open with that chaos hair in his eyes, and I wanted and didn't want, and I had to say something.
"I doubt it," was the best I could do.
His face was inches from mine. I was going to kiss him, and I was going to regret it. But at that moment, I couldn't bring myself to care.
Chapter 18. I heard he emailed a picture of his...
"Oh, hi, Noah."
The voice stopped mid-sentence, and I could hear the coy smile in it. Noah closed his eyes. He stepped away from me and turned to face the intruders. I blinked, trying to bring everything back into focus.
"Ladies," he said to the open-mouthed girls and nodded. Then he walked out.
The girls giggled, stealing sidelong glances at me while they fixed their melting makeup in front of the mirror. I was still slack-jawed and shell-shocked, staring at the door. Only when the bell rang did I finally remember how to walk. I didn't see Noah again until Wednesday night. I spent the day mildly freaked out from lack of sleep, general malaise, and angst over what had happened between us. On Monday, he'd walked out on me like it was nothing, like Jamie warned me he would, and I'd be lying if I said it didn't sting. I had no idea what, if anything, I was going to say to Noah when I saw him, but English came and went, and he didn't show. I dutifully took notes from Miss Lieb and loitered outside of the class when it ended, scanning the campus for Noah without understanding why. In algebra, I tried to focus on the polynomials and parabolas, but it was becoming painfully clear that while I could coast in bio, history, and English, I was struggling in math. Mr. Walsh called on me twice in class, and I gave a grievously wrong answer each time. Each homework assignment I'd submitted was returned with angry red pencil marks all over it, punctuated by a disgraceful score at the bottom of the page. Exams were in a few weeks, and I had no hope of catching up. When class ended, an odd bit of conversation caught my attention, scattering my thoughts.
"I heard she was eaten after he killed her. Some kind of cannibal thing," a girl said behind me. She punctuated her remark with a crack of her gum. I turned around.
"You're an idiot, Jennifer,"
a guy named Kent, I think, shot back at her.
"Eaten by alligators, not the pedophile."
Before I could hear more, Jamie dropped his binder on my desk. "Hey, Mara. Did you hear that?" I asked him, as Jennifer and Kent left the classroom. Jamie looked confused at first, but then understanding transformed his face.
"Oh, Jordana."
"What?"
The name rang a bell, and I tried to remember why.
"That's who they were talking about, Jordana Palmer. She was a sophomore at Dade High. I know someone who knew her. Well, kind of. It's really sad."
The pieces clicked into place.
"I think I heard something about it on the news," I said quietly. "What happened to her?"
"I don't know the whole story, just that she was supposed to show up at a friend's house and then didn't. They found her body a few days later, and she was definitely murdered, but I haven't heard how yet. Her dad's a cop, and I think they're keeping it quiet or something. Hey, you okay?"
That's when I tasted the blood. Apparently, I'd chewed on the skin of my bottom lip until it split. I flicked out my tongue to catch the drop.
"No," I said truthfully as I made my way outside.
Jamie followed me.
"Care to share?"
I didn't, but when I met Jamie's eyes, it was like I didn't have a choice. The weight of all the weirdness, the asylum, Rachel, Noah,
All of it just bubbled up, trying to claw its way out of my throat. I was in an accident before we moved here. My best friend died. I practically vomited the words. I closed my eyes and exhaled, appalled by my overshare. What was wrong with me? I'm sorry, Jamie said, lowering his eyes. I'd made him feel awkward. Fabulous. It's okay. I'm okay. I don't know why I just said that. Jamie shifted uncomfortably. It's cool, he said, then he smiled. So when do you want to study algebra? A random segue, and a ridiculous one. There was no way Jamie would benefit from having me as a study partner, not when he nailed each and every question Mr. Walsh lobbed at him. You are aware that my math skills are even more lacking than my social skills. Impossible. Jamie's mouth spread into a mocking grin. Thanks. Seriously, you must have better things to do with your life than waste it on the hopeless. I've already learned Parseltongue. What else is there? Elvish? You're like a genuine nerd. Love it. Meet me at the picnic tables during lunch. Bring your brain and something for it to do, he said as he walked away. Oh, your flap's open, by the way, he called over his shoulder. Excuse me? Jamie pointed at my messenger bag with a grin, then strolled to his next class. I closed my bag. When I met him at the appointed time, math textbook in hand, he was all smiles, ready and waiting to bear witness to my idiocy. He took out his graph paper and textbook, but my mind glazed over as soon as I glanced at the numbers on the glossy page. I had to will myself to focus on what Jamie was saying as he wrote out the equation and explained it patiently. But after only minutes, as if a switch had been flipped in my brain, the numbers began to make sense. We worked through problem after problem until all of the week's homework was finished. Half an hour for what would normally have taken me 2 and netted me an F for my efforts, and my work was perfect. I gave a low whistle. Damn, you're good. It's all you, Mara. I shook my head. He nodded his. All right, I acquiesced. Either way, thanks. He bent into an exaggerated bow before we headed to Spanish. We made meaningless small talk on the way, steering clear of dead people as a topic of conversation. When we reached the classroom, Morales lumbered up from her desk to the blackboard and wrote down a series of verbs for us to conjugate. Characteristically, she called on me first. I answered wrong. She threw a piece of chalk at me, scattering my good mood from my lunchtime study session into a million pieces. When class ended, Jamie offered to help me with Spanish, too. I accepted. At the end of the day, I stuffed my now unnecessary textbook in my locker. I needed to spend some quality time with my sketchbook, not drawing Noah, not drawing anyone. I shifted my books to one side of the locker and searched through a week's worth of refuse, but didn't see it. I leafed through my messenger bag, but it wasn't there either. Irritated, I dropped my bag so I could focus, and it slid against the bottom row of lockers, dislodging some pink flyers taped to the metal before it hit the concrete. Still nothing. I started pulling out my books one at a time as raw, arctic fear coiled in my stomach. Faster and faster, I tore through my things and let them fall to the ground until I was staring at my empty locker. My sketchbook was gone. Tears threatened my eyes, but a bunch of students walked into the locker niche, and I refused to cry in public. Sluggishly, I put my books back into my locker and removed the flyer that was now stuck to the front of my algebra textbook. A costume party on South Beach hosted by one of Croydon's elite, in honor of the teacher workday tomorrow. I didn't bother reading the rest of the details before letting it fall to the ground again. Not my scene. None of this was my scene. Not Florida and its hordes of tan blondes and mosquitoes. Not Croydon and its painfully generic student body. I made a friend in Jamie, but I missed Rachel, and she was gone. Screw it. I ripped a flyer off another locker and shoved it in my messenger bag. I needed a party. I jogged to the back gate to meet Daniel. He looked uncharacteristically cool in the Croydon uniform, and happy until he saw me. Then his face transformed into a mask of brotherly concern. "You're looking unusually glum this afternoon," he said. I got in the car. I lost my sketchbook. "Oh," he said, and after a beat, "was there anything important in it?" Other than the several detailed sketches of the most infuriatingly beautiful person in our school, no, not really. I changed the subject. "What were you looking so happy about before I curdled your good mood? Did I look happy?" "I don't remember looking happy," he said. He was stalling and speeding. I glanced at the odometer. He was doing over 50 miles per hour before we got to the highway. Living dangerously for Daniel. Very suspicious. "You looked happy," I said to him. "Spill." "I'm going to the party tonight." I did a double take. It definitely wasn't Daniel's scene. "Who are you going with?" He blushed and shrugged.
No way. Did my brother have a crush? Who? I demanded. The violinist, Sophie. I stared at him, mouth agape. It's not a date, he added immediately. I'm just meeting her there. The beginnings of an idea sprouted as we turned off the highway. Mind if I tag along? I asked. Now it was Daniel's turn to double take. I promise not to interfere with your amorous advances. You know, I was going to say yes, but now... Oh, come on, I just need a ride. All right, but who are you going to see, pray tell? Huh. I hadn't planned to see anyone. I just wanted to dance and sweat and forget and... What the hell? Daniel whispered as we rounded the corner of our street. A massive gathering of news vans and people lined the pavement in front of our driveway. Daniel and I looked at each other, and I knew we shared the same thought. Something was wrong. Chapter 19. The sea of reporters parted for Daniel's car as he pulled into the driveway. They peered at us as we rolled by. The cameraman seemed to be packing up their equipment, and the satellites on the vans had been retracting into the vehicles. Whatever had happened, they were getting ready to leave. As soon as Daniel came to a stop, I rocketed out of the car toward the front door, passing both my mother and father's car. My father's car, which didn't belong here this early. I was ready to be sick when I finally burst into the house with Daniel behind me. Electronic machine gun fire and video game music met my ears, and the familiar shape of our little brother's head stared up at the screen from his cross-legged position on the floor. I closed my eyes and breathed through flared nostrils, trying to slow my heart before it exploded in my chest. Daniel was the first to speak. What the hell is going on? Joseph half turned and looked at Daniel, annoyed at the interruption. Dad took on some kind of big case. Can you turn that off? One sec, I don't want to die. Joseph's avatar bludgeoned a mustachioed villain into a thick, oozing puddle of goo. My parents appeared soundlessly in the doorframe of the kitchen. Turn it off, Joseph. My mom sounded exhausted. My brother sighed and paused the game. What's happening? Daniel asked. A case of mine is going to trial soon, my father said, and I was announced as the defendant's new counsel today. A shadow of comprehension passed over my older brother's face, but I didn't get it. We just moved here, I said. Isn't that, like, unusually fast? My mother and father exchanged a look. There was definitely something I was missing. What? What's going on? I took over the case for a friend of mine, my father said. Why? He withdrew. Okay. Before we moved here. I paused to absorb what I was hearing. So you had the case before we moved to Florida? Yes. That shouldn't matter unless I swallowed and asked the question I already knew the answer to. What is it? What case? The Palmer murder. I massaged my forehead. No big deal. My father had defended murder cases before, and I tried to calm the nausea that unsettled my stomach. My mother started assembling ingredients from the pantry for dinner, and for no reason, no good reason at all, I pictured human body parts on a plate. I shook my head to clear it. Why didn't you tell us? I asked my father, then glanced at Daniel, wondering why he was so quiet. He avoided my gaze. Ah, they didn't tell me. We didn't want you to have to worry about it, not after... He started, then stopped. But now that things are heating up, I guess it's better this way. You remember my friend Nathan Gold? My father asked me. I nodded. When he found out we were moving, he asked me to take the case for him. I'm going to be doing some press conferences over the next couple of weeks. I don't know how they got the address here. I should have had Gloria send out a release about the substitution before it leaked, he said, mostly to himself. And that was all fine, but I hated that they were treating me like some delicate, fragile thing. And let's be honest, it probably wasn't they. I had no doubt that my mother, as my unofficial treating psychologist, was responsible for the information that did and did not flow my way. I turned to her. You could have told me, you know. She silently hid behind the open refrigerator. I talked to her anyway. I miss my friends, and yeah, it's messed up that this girl died, but it has nothing to do with what happened to Rachel. You don't have to keep me in the dark about stuff like this. I don't understand why you're treating me like I'm two. Joseph, go do your homework, my mother said. My brother had been inching his way back into the living room, having almost reached the controller by the time she said his name. But there's no school tomorrow. Then go to your room. What did I do? He whined. Nothing. I just want to talk to your sister for a minute. Mom, Daniel interrupted. Not now, Daniel. You know what, Mom? Talk to Daniel, I said. I have nothing else to say.
My mother didn't speak. She looked tired, beautiful as usual, but tired. The recessed lighting haloed her dark hair. After a pause, Daniel spoke again.
"So, there's a party tonight, and you can go," my mother said.
"Thanks. I thought I'd take Mara with me." My mother turned her back to me and gave Daniel her full attention. Daniel made eye contact with me over her shoulder and shrugged, as if to say, "It's the least I can do." My mother hesitated before saying, "It's a school night." Of course, that only bothered her when I was the subject of the conversation.
"There's no school tomorrow," Daniel said.
"Where is it?"
"South Beach," Daniel said.
"And you're going to be there the whole time?"
"Yes, I won't leave her alone."
She turned to my father.
"Marcus, it's fine with me," my dad said.
My mother then looked at me carefully. She didn't trust me for a hot minute, but she trusted her perfect eldest child. A conundrum.
"All right," she said finally. "Be home by 11, though. No excuses." It was an impressive display of Daniel's influence, I'll admit. Not quite enough to make me forget how irritated I was with our mother, but the prospect of getting out of the house and going somewhere that wasn't school did lift my mood. Maybe tonight I could actually have fun. I left the kitchen to shower. The hot water scalded my thin shoulder blades, and I slumped against the tile and let the water glide over my skin. I needed to think of a costume. I did not want to be the only person wearing the wrong thing again. I stepped out of the shower and threw on a t-shirt and yoga pants before untangling my rat's nest of wet hair. Rifling through my dresser would be hopeless. Same with my closet. But my mother's closet. Most of the time she wore suit pants or a skirt and a button-down shirt. Always professional. Thoroughly American. But I knew she had a sari or two buried somewhere in that enormous monochromatic wardrobe of hers. It could work. I tiptoed to my parents' room and cracked open the door. They were still in the kitchen. I began searching through my mother's clothes, looking for something suitable.
"Mara?"
"Oops." I turned around. The stress was evident in my mother's face, her skin taut over her high cheekbones. "I was just looking for something to wear," I said.
"Sorry."
"It's okay, Mara. I just wish we could..." I inhaled slowly.
"Can we do this later? Daniel said there's gonna be traffic and I have to figure out a costume."
My mother's forehead creased. I knew she wanted to say something, but I hoped she'd let it go, just this once. I was surprised when the conspiratorial smile slowly transformed her face.
"It's a costume party?" she asked.
I nodded.
"I think I might have something," she said.
She brushed past me and disappeared into the depths of her walk-in closet. After a few minutes, my mother emerged holding a garment bag that she cradled like a small child, and a pair of perilously high, strappy heels that dangled from her fingers.
"This should fit you."
I eyed the bag warily.
"It's not a wedding gown, is it?"
"No," she smiled and handed it to me. "It's a dress. One of my mother's. Take my red lipstick and pin up your hair, and you can go as a vintage model." A smile spread across my face, matching my mother's.
"Thanks,"
I said, and meant it. "Just do me this one favor." I raised my eyebrows, waiting for the caveat. "Stay with Daniel." Her voice was strained, and I felt guilty, again. I nodded and thanked her again for the dress before I made my way back to my room to try it on. The firm plastic of the garment bag rustled as I unzipped it. A dark emerald green silk shimmered from inside. I withdrew the dress from the bag, and my breath caught in my throat. It was stunning. I hoped it fit. I went to my bathroom to attempt to put on mascara without impaling my eyeball. But when I looked in the mirror, Claire stood behind my reflection. She winked.
"You two kids have fun."
Chapter 20. I shot out of my bathroom and sat on my bed, my mouth dry and my hands trembling. I wanted to scream, but I closed my eyes and forced myself to breathe. Claire was dead. She was not in my bathroom, and there was nothing to be scared of. My mind was playing tricks on me. I was going to a party tonight, and I needed to get dressed. One thing at a time. Makeup first. I made my way back to the mirror behind my bedroom door, but stopped. There was no one there. Just the PTSD. But why risk it? I padded down the hallway, back to my parents' bedroom. "Mom?" I asked, poking my head in the door. She sat in her bed, legs crossed, as she typed on her laptop. She looked up. "Will you do my makeup?" I asked her. Her smile couldn't have been more enthusiastic. She ushered me into her bathroom and sat me down on a chair in front of the vanity. I tilted away from the mirror, just in case. I felt my mother line my eyes, but when she pulled out her lipstick, I stopped her. "Pass. It makes me feel like a clown." She nodded with mock seriousness and went back to work.
twisting and pinning my hair behind my head so tightly that my face ached. When she was done, she told me to look in the mirror. I smiled at her, the exact opposite of my internal reaction. "You know what? I trust you," I said, and kissed her on the cheek before leaving the room. "Wait a second," my mother called after me. I stopped and she opened her jewelry box. She withdrew a pair of earrings, a single emerald at the center of each stud, surrounded by diamonds. "Oh my God," I said, staring at them. They were incredible. "Mom, I can't..." "Just to borrow, not to keep," she said with a smile. "Here, stand still." She fastened the studs to my ears. "There," she said, her hands on my shoulders. "You look beautiful." I smiled. "Thank you." "You're welcome, but don't lose them, okay? They were my mother's." I nodded and went back to my room. It was time to deal with the dress. I withdrew it from the garment bag. Stepping into it would be safest. That way, I could stop if it threatened to tear. To my great surprise, it slid on easily, but it dipped dangerously low in the front and dangerously low in the back, exposing more skin than I was used to. Much more. Too late now. A glance at the clock told me I had only 5 minutes before Daniel had to leave to meet his little nerdlet. I slipped on the shoes my mother had given me. They were slightly too tight, but I ignored that, and balancing mostly on my toes, walked into the foyer. I met Joseph as he headed to his room.
"Oh my God, Daniel, you have to see Mara!"
Blushing furiously, I pushed past him and stood by the front door, itching to fling it open, and wait in the car for my older brother, but he had the keys. Of course he did. Daniel materialized from the hallway in a business suit with his hair slicked back and wet-looking, and my mother appeared shortly after. They stood there and stared for much longer than was necessary while I fidgeted, feigning boredom to hide my embarrassment. Finally, Daniel spoke.
"Wow, Mara, you look like...
His face scrunched as he searched for words. A look passed over my mother's face, but vanished before I could interpret it. "Like a model," Mom said brightly.
I was gonna say a lady of ill repute.
I shot Daniel a look of pure poison.
But sure.
"She does not, Daniel, stop it." The golden boy was scolded. I smirked.
"You look beautiful, Mara. Older, too."
"Daniel," my mother said and turned to look at him in the eye. "Watch her. Don't let her out of your sight." He raised his hand in salute.
"Yes, ma'am."
Once we were in the car, Daniel put on some Indian music. He knew I was not a fan. "Can I change it?"
"No."
I glared at him, but he ignored me as he pulled out of the driveway. We didn't talk until we reached the highway.
"So what are you supposed to be anyway?"
I asked him as we lined up behind the mass of cars, stalled and blinking in the traffic.
"Bruce Wayne."
"Ha!" "I'm sorry, by the way," he paused, still watching the road, "for not telling you about the case." I didn't say anything. "Mom asked me not to." I stared straight ahead.
"So naturally you listened.
She thought she was doing the right thing. I wish she'd stop." Daniel shrugged, and we were silent for the rest of the drive. We crept along in traffic till we finally turned onto Lincoln Road.
It really was captivating.
Neon lights illuminated the buildings, some sleek and some gaudy. Drag queens glittered down the sidewalks next to scantily clad revelers. Parking was impossible, but we eventually found a space near the club and paid an obscene amount of money for the privilege. As I got out of the car, my feet crunched on the broken glass that dusted the pavement. I walked behind Daniel slowly and carefully, knowing that one misstep would send me hurtling toward the glass and cigarette-littered concrete, thereby ruining my normal teenager excursion and the dress. We stood in line and waited our turn. When we reached the stereotypically muscled bouncer, we handed over our cash for the cover charge and he stamped our hands without ceremony. Daniel and I walked past the rope into the pulsing club and I could tell his confidence had worn a bit thin. In our lack of partying experiences, at least, we were equals. The room was a wall-to-wall throbbing mass of bodies. They writhed synchronously around us as we pushed our way in shoulder to shoulder. The level of undress was truly impressive. A handful of whorish angels, devils, and fairies teetered toward the bar in stilettos, sucking in their torsos and puffing out their twinkling cleavage. Much to my dismay, I spotted Anna among them. She had shed her usually wholesome ensemble for a staggeringly sparse angel getup with the requisite halo and wings. She overdid it on the makeup, the push-up bra, and the heels, and looked well on her way to ending up as some accountant's midlife crisis.
I grabbed my brother by the arm, and he steered us to the other side of the bar, where we were supposed to meet his crush. As we waited, I recognized the song being sampled in the remix that thrummed from the speakers and smiled to myself. Daniel tapped me on the shoulder a few minutes later, and I followed his eyes until he smiled at a petite blonde girl dressed in overalls with fake grease paint smudged on her face. She mouthed or screamed my brother's name. It was impossible to tell. The music swallowed up every other sound in the space. Her short hair bounced and swayed under her chin as she made her way over. When she reached us, Daniel leaned into her ear to introduce us.
"This is Sophie," he shouted.
I nodded and smiled at her. She was cute. Daniel did nicely.
"Nice to meet you," I screamed.
"What?" she screamed back.
"Nice to meet you."
The look on her face revealed that she still couldn't hear me. "Alrighty then." The music changed to a slower rhythmic beat, and Sophie started to pull Daniel away from me and into the throng of people. He turned to me, for approval, I assumed, and I waved him on. When he was gone, though, I began to feel awkward. I pressed into the bar that wouldn't serve me, with no discernible purpose or reason for being there. What did I expect? I came to dance, and I came with my brother, who was meeting someone else. I should have asked Jamie. I was stupid. Now I had no choice but to just plunge into the crowd and start gyrating, because that wouldn't be weird. I lolled my head back in hopelessness and leaned back into the dull edge of the metal bar. When I righted myself, two guys, one in a Miami Heat jersey and the other in what I hoped was an ironic portrayal of a perpetually shirtless, moronic reality TV person, made eye contact. Completely not interested, I looked away, but in my peripheral vision, saw that they were edging themselves closer. I graciously darted into the crowd and only narrowly avoided being elbowed in the face by a girl attired in what could only be described as slutty Gryffindor apparel. So wrong. When I finally reached the far wall, my eyes swept the crowd, absorbing the near-naked bodies and the costumes, and trying to see if I recognized anyone not heinous from school. I did. Noah was fully clothed and, as far as I could tell, uncostumed. He wore dark jeans and a hoodie, apparently despite the heat, and he was talking to a girl. A stunningly beautiful slip of a girl, all legs crowned by a tiny twinkling dress and fairy wings. She looked oddly familiar, but I couldn't place her. She probably went to our school. Noah listened raptly to whatever she was saying, and a semicircle of costumed girls surrounded her. A devil, a cat, an angel, and a carrot? Huh? I liked Vegetable Girl, but the rest of them I hated. At precisely that moment, Noah's head lifted and he saw me staring. I couldn't read his expression, even as he leaned over to the fairy and said something in her ear. She turned to look at me. Noah reached out to stop her, but not before my eyes met hers. She giggled and covered her mouth before turning back around. Noah was making fun of me. Humiliation spread from the pit of my stomach and lodged in my throat. I twisted around and pushed my way through the bodies that had encroached into my bubble of personal space. As badly as I had wanted to come tonight, I now wanted to leave. I found Daniel and screamed in his ear that I wasn't feeling well and asked Sophie if she could give him a ride back. Daniel was worried. He insisted on driving me home, but I wasn't having it. I told him I just needed to get some air, and eventually he handed me the keys and let me go. I bit back my embarrassment and hurried toward the exit. As I pushed through the throng, I thought I heard my name shouted behind me. I stopped, swallowed, and against my better judgment, turned around. No one was there.
Chapter 21. By the time I arrived back at the house, I'd composed myself. Coming home with a tear-streaked face and without Daniel would not help my situation with my mother, and we were just starting to make some progress. But when I pulled into the driveway, her car wasn't there. Neither was my father's. The lights inside the house were off, too. Where were they? I went to the front door and reached out to unlock it. The door swung in before I touched it. I stood there, my fingers mere inches from the handle. I stared, my heart in my throat, and raised my eyes slowly up the length of the door. Nothing unusual. Maybe they just forgot to lock it? With one hand, I pushed the door open the rest of the way and stood in the doorframe, peering into the dark house. The lights in the foyer, living room, and dining room were off, but a sliver of light peeked out from around the corner toward the family room. They must have left that one on. My eyes roamed, The art was still on the wall. The antique ebony and mother-of-pearl Chinese screen was in the same place as when I left. Everything was where it should be. I inhaled, closed the door behind me, and flipped on all the front lights in quick succession. Better. When I went into the kitchen to get something to eat,